I don't know about you, but I am watching world events very closely at this point in time. I am watching those world events in light of prophecy. Now, I know that a lot of people have a lot of problems with prophetical teaching of the Bible. But once you become aware of what the Bible is teaching about prophecy and world events and the signs of the times, you will begin to look up, for his coming draweth nigh. And there are a lot of things happening in the world, and there are a lot of things that will happen in 1990. You can go to bed one night and get up the next morning and the stock exchange has dropped 600%. You will go to bed one night and get up the next day and you will not have a cent in the bank. Oh, you might have thought you had, but you won't have. You think about it. People in Germany in 1948 went to bed one night and got up the next day and had no money. Only what the government allocated to them. You say, well, it won't happen here in Australia. My baby sister crying on the phone the other week said, Ronnie, I didn't think it would ever happen. I didn't think we'd ever have an earthquake. Famous last words of Christians, primarily. It won't happen to me. It'll happen. And I want to tell you tonight, I'll be glad when it does happen. You know why? Because a lot of Christians might get back on their knees where they belong. Now, in the book of Esther, we have the story of a power struggle. And if you look around the world today, that is exactly what is happening. Story after story of power struggle. Whether it be Manila, Panama, whether it be Romania, Czechoslovakia, doesn't really matter, wherever. The power struggle is on. And even here in this country, there's been a power struggle, a challenge, or if you like, the gauntlet laid down to become the number one ruler. Well, you'll know all about that when the one world government comes into being. You'll know all about it when the monetary system is unified and controlled by the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers. And I think I might even be around for you to come and say to me, it did happen. Well, the challenge for us all here tonight in this gospel service is found in the words of Mordecai to Esther, or to Myrtle. I like to call her by her Jewish name, Myrtle. And Mordecai said to Myrtle, who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Now, like all power struggles, it is good to know a little history behind the struggle, isn't it? The year 586 BC was a year when Israel was at its lowest. And that's when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, swept upon Jerusalem and he just annihilated it. God's judgment had been foretold before by the prophets, and it finally came upon his own people, and then there was a period of captivity and exile began for them. And I remember when I was in theological training studying the Persian and the Medes. I used to call them the Martins and the Coys, because that was a hillbilly song I sang, and it used to help me associate the Medes and the Persians for examination time. Now, even whilst they were in captivity, God still watched over his people, but he was teaching them a lesson. He was training them, and he was educating them, and certainly they were far away from their own land. They were in a strange land, as a matter of fact. Now, some years after all of this happened, in approximately 539 BC, Persia then bursts upon the world scene and captures Babylon this time. And Cyrus was king of Persia at the time, and really was a great battle, a lot of bloodshed. Well, I won't go into the gory details just in case you're weak in the stomach. But Israel's enemy itself then had been taken over, and Cyrus himself had no quarrel with the exiled Jews. So he gave them permission to go back to their own land. And thousands of them took advantage of this and went back. But some of them couldn't afford to go back, and for other reasons, some of them stayed back. Now, some of them did exactly what the Jews did in Germany in 1930. They stayed back because they were wealthy and they started to buy up cheap properties. Well, of these that stayed behind, two are mentioned in particular for our benefit. Mordecai and Myrtle. Well, Mordecai, he had a very important position in the early days. He was involved there in the court in Susa, the capital, and chapter 2 and verse 5 will tell you that. Also, this little orphan girl, she was an orphan, and she had this intriguing Jewish name, Myrtle. Of course, in the Hebrew, it's Tadasha. This girl, of course, is known to you and to biblical scholars as Esther, which is her Persian name. Well, she was Mordecai's young cousin, and because she was an orphan, she was brought up by Mordecai. He took care of her. Now, for those of you in the congregation who like drama, and drama that is well done is worth watching. There is a tremendous amount of drama in this story, this book of Esther, and there are many characters. We've got the king, we've got the queen, we've got Haman. Did you know that Haman was an Amalekite? And you know that the Amalekites hate the Jews? Now remember that, as the sermon goes on tonight. He was an Amalekite. Now all of these characters, they all feature in a power struggle, and that's what the book of Esther is all about. But from within the pages of this power struggle, we learn that God really cares for his people and will further his own purposes in and through the events of human history. What am I saying to you tonight? I'm saying to you that God is in control and still in control. Now, the story opens in 536 BC, and it's the third year of the king's reign, Xerxes. It opens with a tremendous slap-up dinner, a big time of celebration. It must have been quite a celebration, because all the governors of Persia's 127 provinces were invited. And they came from all over India and Ethiopia. The host of the party was the most powerful man at that time. Now, I want us to look at what really this book says. Now, we see a monarch here who wasted his power. And whilst under the influence of alcohol, the king decided to do several crazy things, which are recorded in verse 10 and 11 of chapter 1. He decides to show off the queen, Vashti. She was beautiful. He wanted to show her off in public, but he wanted to show her off in the front or in the face of all his drunken male guests. And of course she refused to be paraded before a room full of drunken men. Well, that refusal caused the king to throw a tantrum. You ever seen people like that? When they can't get their own way, they throw a tantrum. They're not all children either. You see, the king asked his advisors. He was a bit weak in the head. He says to his advisors, he says, "What will I do about it?" To which they replied, "Get rid of her." And getting rid of the queen was also a message that let the women of that day know that the men ruled. Now, whether that was good or bad, we won't get into that debate soon. But verse 17 of chapter 1 will tell you the details of how the queen came to be banished from the palace. And a new queen must be found. So chapter 2 opens with a beauty contest. They've been around a long time, these beauty contests. And of course, Myrtle, little Myrtle, had now grown up. And it's at this point that God, the God of the impossible, begins to intervene. You see, Myrtle was picked for the beauty contest. The Bible tells us that she must have been beautiful because she won the contest. And so she became Queen Esther. The God of the impossible begins to move. Then secondly, we notice the outstanding feature of her becoming queen. She is now the queen who was wedded to power. The king wasted his power. The queen is now wedded to power. And in the eyes of man, that was the first impossible thing. Myrtle, a Jewess, as queen of Persia. Never heard of! Well, Mordecai was the only one that knew about her ancestry, and it seems as though he wasn't going to tell anybody else, and it seems as though nobody else knew about it either. And Mordecai was determined to keep it that way. And so Esther wore the regal crown, and she attended the banquets in her honor, And the best kept secret in Persia remained a secret. As this story unfolds, it is not the only story of the king who was stupid. There are others in the Bible. But it's the story of a king who wasted his power. But it also is a story of the queen, the Jewish queen, who was wedded to power. And the principle here is simply this. God never forgets his people. Little did the Jews of Persia know what awaited them. But God knew, and God's timing is always perfect. And so God puts Esther on the throne of Persia, and this gives Mordecai, God's servant, a vital link with the king. Well, we know from our history books that no life was secure in Persia at that moment. Not even the king was secure. You see, cut off from reality and surrounded by stooges and yes men, the king's life was anything but secure. So, an assassination plot was put into operation. This is all up to date, isn't it? Very relevant. Chapter 2, verse 21 tells us that some characters like Bigfin and Teresh were the motivators in the incident. But the whole idea went wrong from the start. Somebody blabbed. You'd think it was a Baptist church. There was a leak. And eventually Mordecai, who always had his ear close to the ground, got wind of the plot. Well, Mordecai sent word to Esther, and Esther got word to the king, and so the would-be assassins were arrested and tried and executed. What do we see happening now? We see that Haman, the Amalekite, for what he is, oh, he's a real nasty character, this bloke. You see, Haman is next to the king. And we see Haman as the statesman who lusted for power. A bit like some people in Parliament, isn't it? Well, chapter 3 and verse 1 shows us that Haman was already in a very powerful position, second only to the king. And the command goes out in verse 2 that all and sundry are to bow down and reverence Haman, not the king, but Haman. But Mordecai refused. He refused to bow down. I'm sure he would have acknowledged the king, but not Haman. And if you understand your Bible prophecy and your Bible history, you will be aware that no Jew would bow to an Amalekite. Well, Mordecai refused. But in all probability, I like the sense of humor as I read the book, that Haman probably didn't notice that Mordecai had refused to bow, but someone told him. Someone told him. You know who won't bow down to you, don't you, Haman? It's Mordecai. And Haman, he's a Jew. Well, that should have got the blood in the Amalekite raging, shouldn't it? Well, that was enough to make Haman explode. And Haman being an Amalekite, he was hardly a friend of the Jews. Now, when Mordecai refused to bow down and just be another nobody, he represented a somebody who had to be crushed. Think of that. Think of the somebodies in the world who have been crushed because they've stood up for their convictions. And Haman persuades the king that all Jews should be wiped out. So chapter 3, verse 15 reveals that while the king and Haman celebrated, couriers are dispatched in every direction with the decree. Now, this decree became the law of the Medes and the Persians, and it couldn't be revoked. Nothing now could save the Jews. That is, so Haman thought. Now, this is where God's servant Mordecai comes into action, and I want you to listen, because Mordecai is the servant of God who utilized power. Something Christians need to learn a lot about. Because of the situation as it is now, it was impossible for Mordecai to get near Esther. So he does the next best thing, which was to attract her attention through the women who waited on her. Chapter 4 tells us that these women said to Esther, "Your Majesty, there is an extraordinary fellow at the front gate jumping around in sackcloth, ripping his shirt into ribbons and shampooing his head with ashes.
He looks a bit like that cousin of yours.
So the queen put two and two together and sent out a catch, one of the few palace servants she could trust, and Mordecai tells him the whole story of Haman's hatred, of his crafty scheme regarding the decree and the impending fate of all the Jews. Now they're going to be wiped out. And so the servant then reports this to Esther, and Esther is absolutely scared stiff. She is a Jewess, remember? So she finds difficulty in telling the king. So she sends word back to Mordecai, saying how inaccessible the king is. Chapter 4 and verse 11. But Mordecai sends back a stern message in verse 13, saying, Esther, don't think that just because you are in the palace, that you are going to escape the massacre. If you don't act now, deliverance will come for the Jews, all right. But you and your father's house will perish. And Esther, by the way, who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? In simple language, Mordecai is saying, don't you understand, Myrtle? Don't you understand the only reason that you have been allowed to come to the throne, the only reason you have been wedded to power, is for this moment? So get your act together. Go and see the king and plead for your people. Who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Well, I wonder whether you believe that God has plans for individual lives. I believe he has. You see, the Bible makes it very plain that God does not have the same plan. He has a plan for your life. But it is the discovering of God's will that determines how that plan and purpose is executed. Mordecai was in touch with God, and he saw that power can be used to further God's plan. Now, each of us is in a unique position to reach friends for Christ, are we not? To influence certain situations for God's kingdom. Are we doing it? No. Oh, no. Don't write a letter. Don't even challenge the television stations for putting all that smut on TV. Oh, look, no, we shouldn't do that. Don't do that. You know, we're weak-kneed, aren't we? If we are truly Christian, if we are truly God's people, we will stand up and be counted, because the blood of martyrs is the seed of the church. You might even be shot in your own home before long. Well, we need to see to it that our position in life for God and the kingdom is what God has ordained. You see, God is concerned that the full potential of every life is fulfilled. Yes, Mordecai was the faithful servant who utilized power, even though he was not in the position of any ultimate power at that point in time. But he was able to prod the person who was near to power, the queen, until finally Esther says, okay, go gather every jewel that can be found, get them to pray and fast for me, and then I'll talk with the king. Verse 15 and 16 of chapter 4. And I want to tell you tonight, there is power, there is authority in praying and fasting. Something we don't do much about nowadays. Now in chapter 5, we read of how Esther walks into the king's court. And she holds her breath as the king's scepter is held out toward her. And here is her opportunity. And the king says, what is it, Esther? What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given you even to the half of my kingdom. Now, if you had been Esther, what would you have said? Did you expect Esther to say, oh, king, live forever. Please save my people. We are all going to be murdered in our beds because of your decree. Please save us. Oh, no, Esther didn't say that. She simply said, your majesty, would you like to come to dinner tonight? And would you like to bring your friend Haman? Now Esther had her head screwed on the right way. So the king smiled and he said, anything you like, my dear. Anything, anything. It's very kind of you to invite us. Well, Haman arrived on time for dinner. And during the dinner, the king asked Esther again, what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled. But If you look closely at verse 8 of the chapter, you will see that it answers her request, which was not a request to save her people, but a request for another dinner date with the king and Haman. And of course, Haman is pleased about this. But he realized this was of no advantage to him. As long as he could see and had to see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. So in verse 14, we see that Haman's wife gives him some good advice. Now, with all due respect, she was not an intelligent woman. She says, "Behold, Haman, let me tell you what to do." Mistake number one. "Build a gallows," she says, 50 cubits high for Mordecai, and tomorrow morning we will tell the king to hang Haman on." So Mordecai's fate seemed fixed, and all that night a crash program of gallows building went on in Haman's backyard, ready for the morning. Now I want to come to another impossibility. The God of the impossible intervenes again. He steps right into the arena. Chapter 6 opens with the simple statement, "On that night the king could not sleep." Isn't God's timing perfect? On that night, of all nights, the king could not sleep. Well, I don't know about you, what you do when you can't sleep, but I know what I do. Well, now the king decided to read some history books. Now, that's not a bad pastime. So the Bible says, "On that night the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the books of the memorable deeds, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was during the reading that he heard the recorded account of the attempted assassination on his life, and how Mordecai saved him from this assassination." And the king sat up in his bed. And then he inquired, he said, "How did we reward Mordecai for his faithful service in this episode?" His men replied, "Your Majesty, nothing has been done for him." Well, whilst this is going on, of course, Haman's in the courtyard outside. It's nearly daytime, nearly morning. And then the king says, "Show Haman in." He spotted him out of his bedroom window, you know, like these sneaks that always are sneaking around. You can spot him out of the corner of your eye. He says, "Show him in." And as Haman walks into the royal bedroom, his mind is full of Mordecai, what he's going to do to him. He's got these gallows built. He's going to hang him if the king will say so. And he's bursting to tell the king how they can finish off Mordecai. But what Haman doesn't know is that the king's mind is also full of Mordecai. And neither knows what the other is thinking. Well, says the king to Haman, "What shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" Verse 7 through 9, Haman starts to list his suggestions. "What shall be done to the man whom the king delights to know? Well, my lord, royal robes and a royal house to sit on, the royal crown on his head, and well, a parade through the streets, and, you know, a public parade. And have him heralded with these words, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Poor old Haman. He honestly thought this was for him. "And yes," says the king, "give him the full works. And Haman, don't forget anything. The robes, the horse, the crown, the public parade. Yes, give him the full works." Oh, Haman, I forgot to mention who the man is. It's Mordecai. At this point, Haman was furious. But for Haman, there was more to come. He now attends the second dinner with the king and the queen. And at this dinner, the king says to Esther again, "What is your request? It shall be granted to you." Now, this time, Esther does really plead for her life and for the life of the Jews. For a moment, the king is taken back by her passionate outburst. The king then wants to know who is planning to kill the Jew. Oh, the king is in a rage at this point, and Esther looks straight into the shifty gaze of Haman and says, "This man is an enemy." Have you ever done that? Have you ever had to do that by the grace of God? I have. Verse 7 of chapter 7 tells us that the king flies into a rage and he goes out in the garden to cool off and then he returns. And when the king returned, Haman starts pleading for his life, but his pleading was shot to pieces. When one of the king's servants, you know, one of those blabbers that had blabbed before, still blabbing, pipes up and says, Haman's got a beautiful new gallows in his backyard, and it's 50 cubits high. I saw it this morning as I passed by. Now, at this point in the story, the next impossible thing has happened. The God of the impossible comes into the arena, and Mordecai has got into power, as chapter 8 and verse 2 reveals. With Haman now hanged, the decree was rewritten, and the king allowed the Jews who were in every city to gather and to defend their lives. The Jews then became so popular that everyone was trying to dig up their family tree to see if they were Jews. Well, don't you think there's coming a day when people are going to try and dig up their family tree to see if they're Christians? Don't you think that'll happen? Be patient. God hasn't finished with us. Well, verse 17 of chapter 8 says, in every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict came, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a feast and a holiday, and many from the people of the country declared themselves Jews, for fear of the Jews had fallen upon them. Did you know that this story of Esther is a story of a power struggle that reveals that God is the ultimate power? Did you know that before? Beloved, please remember that God's timing is perfect, and it is God who has the final monopoly of power in the world. Yes, it is God who really controls the destiny of the lives of his people, and he can bring meaning and purpose out of the incredible mistakes and follies of people like Haman. We have learned tonight about a king who wasted power. We have learned about a young Jewess who was wedded to power. We have learned about a statesman who lusted for power. And we have learned about God's servant who utilized power. And surely we have learned that underneath and behind all of this story is the hand of God that wielded the power. What has God put you in this world for at this moment in history? What are you going to do with your life under God's hand and God's plan? Are you going to come to church every Sunday? And you should. You should be here both services to be taught. You should be here during the week to be taught. But if your life next Lord's Day has not had an impact upon another human being, then you ought to ask yourself the question, why? I'll tell you now, I will not take your excuses this year when you say, I have not won a person to Christ, I cannot win a person to Christ. That will not be accepted. Because I'm just about to give you all job descriptions who are active members. And I'll name you and say that by God's grace, I expect to see you introduce me to someone that you have introduced to Christ. That sure do something for you. You might want to find another church. Go quickly. You see, Mordecai challenges his cousin. Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? What are you doing in Hertford Street Baptist Church at this point in time? God has been showing you what God is doing. Do you believe that? It is a challenge to be faced by God's people of any and every era. We live in a struggling world, a world that is struggling for power. And as Christians, we ought to know the ultimate power.